Thanks for joining us. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. She's off today. She'll be back on Monday. As Hungary cracks down on border crossings, Croatia comes under increasing pressure from the flood of migrants seeking refuge in Europe. Secretary of State John Kerry says the U.S. is prepared to have military-to-military talks with Russia over the Syrian civil war and the fight against ISIS. And the United States warns North Korea of severe consequences if it continues its nuclear expansion. Joining me for this week's top international stories on our Friday News Roundup, David Rothkopf of Foreign Policy, Elise Labbitt of CNN, and David Loyne of the BBC. Welcome to the Diane Rehm Show.
Thanks for having us.
Our listeners can join our conversation with your comments or your questions. You can call our toll-free number. It's 1-800-433-8850. Send us an email. It's drshow@wamu.org. Or you can find us on Facebook or Twitter. Well, this was news just this morning, Elise, about John Kerry's announcement that the Obama administration is ready to accept an offer from Russia for direct talks on its military buildup in Syria. How significant?
Well, it's pretty significant that they are at the point where they need to have talks about what's going on the ground. Now, Secretary Kerry said, kind of tipped his hand a few days ago, he's been trying to talk to Russian Foreign Minister Lavrov several times over the past week about the Russian military buildup in Syria. Russia has said that it's not going after opposition. It's there to fight terrorists, meaning the Islamic State forces who are battling Bashar al-Assad. But clearly, they're being very ambiguous about what their real intentions are. And the U.S. has been very worried about this buildup. You're talking about 6 Russian tanks, 8 helicopters, about 500 Russian troops on the ground, and you're getting more air flights every day of equipment, and the U.S. very concerned. So they've been trying to get a straight answer out of Russia. They have not been able to. So what the Russians have proposed is, let's have military-to-military talks. The U.S. is now billing this as an effort to, quote, deconflict the U.S. Coalition ambitions on the ground after Islamic State with Russian ambitions. But I think they want to sit down with the Russians and say, hey, what are you doing here?
David Rothkopf, you're shaking your head. How come?
Well, I mean, this is a case where the Obama administration was clearly caught flat-footed by the action of this other major power. We are playing catch-up. In addition to the Kerry action, I've seen reports this morning that Secretary of Defense Carter had a conversation with his counterpart in the Kremlin this morning, also dealing with this issue. It is a distraction from the bigger issue of Syria, which, of course, is causing a larger crisis in Europe, and which I believe will be Secretary Kerry's next big move. In other words, after we get the Iran deal behind him, I think he and the diplomatic resources of the U.S. are going to be turned to finding some kind of a political solution in Syria.
David Loyne, what could that solution be? The situation now in Syria just seems like such a mess.
It's a game-changing moment. Russian tanks on the ground in Syria changes the whole dynamic. There's a very live discussion going on in Europe at the moment among a number of governments, particularly in Britain, actually, of people saying we should get involved in Syria with boots on the ground. The ex-defense secretary has been talking about putting in safe havens, no-fly zones. Now, you're not going to be able to do any of that if there are Russian tanks on the ground. They've effectively taken over Damascus Airport. The tanks there are T-90s. They're their latest and most capable warfighting vehicle. And I think you're seeing President Obama now just wondering whether he might talk to Putin. You've got the UN General Assembly later this month. He's decided not to talk to him. They've been cold-shouldering him at every opportunity over the last year. And I think this maneuvering between Kerry and Lavrov, and they get on very well, the Russian Foreign Minister and the US Secretary of State, is all towards potentially talks between Putin and Obama at some point later this year.
What's the worst-case version of what the Russians have in mind with this military buildup in Syria?
Well, they say that all that they're doing is holding on to Assad in power, and he's their only ally in the region. This is Assad. I mean, David says, you know, Russia is pushing forward in a way that America hasn't, but America has plenty of allies in that region. Assad in Syria is Russia's only ally, and they're trying to prop him up.
Well, David, when you talk about a diplomatic solution, how do you manage the battle against ISIS and the U.S. opposition to Assad? How do you make that work?
I think it's very, very tough. I think one potential scenario is that you go in and you work out a deal for a transitional government where Assad is in place for a while and then he leaves and he is granted immunity, which is going to be very hard for the world to swallow. But to get rid of him, they'll swallow it. He'll go off someplace, maybe in the Black Sea. But the Russians, and I think one of the reasons they have tanks there and they've taken this airfield and expanded their presence, is they want to have a voice in who replaces Assad. The Iranians want to have a voice in who replaces Assad. And then once you cut that deal, then you're going to have to do something even harder, and that is going to be cut a deal with Jabhat al-Nusra and say, let's all focus on ISIS first, and then we'll get around to dealing with these other issues.
But it's been really interesting this week watching America running in exactly the opposite direction. I mean, this fascinating story that evidence about ISIS has actually been talked down, that two spies have emerged, and they said there were 50 others. There was this memo that was leaked, that evidence by intelligence officials on the potential threat from ISIS has been talked down in the region. Now, we've been there before, but, of course, in 2003, it was talked up. All the evidence about weapons of mass destruction in Iraq was talked up. We're now in the opposite direction.
Well, at least this was surprising and distressing, these claims that we now have documents that show that senior U.S. military officers manipulated intelligence about the Islamic State. What's behind that?
Well, it's about CENTCOM, right? And so that's the military arm that's, you know, in charge of dealing with that part of the region. And when you talk to senior officials that are consumers of some of that intelligence, they say that, you know, it wasn't so glaring that it really affected what was a very grim picture of what was going on the ground. So it seems to be an isolated case of, you know, some officials in CENTCOM. It's not really clear if that has really driven any assessments of what's going on the ground on ISIS, because I think, you know, most officials that you speak to acknowledge that it's pretty grim. And I think, like all of these things that we've been discussing, I mean, it's obvious until you end the Syrian civil war and you make an accommodation with these groups, as David said, I don't really think there's going to be a solution to ISIS. And this has been the conundrum all the while. How do you end the Syrian civil war, get a political transition, without changing the military equation on the ground? And I think the U.S. has recognized now that unless it gives Russia a greater role, you're not going to do that. The main problem right now is all of us can talk. The U.S. can talk to the Russians, the Iranians, whoever, about a political transition. There is no viable opposition on the ground that could possibly assume a vacuum from
Russia. Well, in fact, we had this shocking testimony this week that the number of U.S.-trained Syrian fighters in Syria, 4 or 5, not 4 or 500, not 4 or 5 thousand, 4 or
right.
5.
Against an investment of $500 million. So they must be the 5 best soldiers in Syria. But having said that, you know, I think it is, in the first instance, I'm not so sure winning in Syria was the objective of anybody. I think the objective in Syria was to create the illusion of action, to look like they're doing it, to calm their critics, and, you know, because they think this is going to be a long-term thing. And there was a very interesting story in the New York Times today in which Peter Baker reported that the White House response to this criticism and the story of this program is not to say, gee, we mismanaged this program. It's to say, see, we told the critics this would be hard to do, and it's the critics' fault for making us do this thing, which is, you know, a kind of mind-boggling abrogation of presidential responsibility.
I think that I understand your point about that it was an illusion to look at. Clearly, it was an Iraq-first strategy, but that's the problem. It was an Iraq-first strategy, and you thought, let's deal with ISIS in Iraq. We'll go to the Syria part later. You see that the both are feeding each other, and you know, you have Syrians crossing back and forth among the ISIS, moving back and forth across the border. I mean, this Syrian civil war, and now you see it bleeding into this migrant crisis in Europe. I mean, if there was a belief that you could deal with that later, I think it's folly.
Well, and David Loin, we see the repercussions of the Syrian civil war in Europe with this flood of migrants. No solution in sight from the EU.
God, it's a mess. I mean, it's really interesting watching from I mean, I came from London this week. It just feels like a total disaster. I mean, all of these people have been pulled through by Germany saying, we will take many refugees. Germany's already taken 500,000 refugees. They're talking about going up to 800,000. That would be 1% of the German population. And the signals that they were sending, apparently welcoming these refugees, has led to the man concerned with immigration, Manfred Schmidt, having to resign because he tweeted at the end of August that Germany would be open to refugees. And you now have the appalling pictures of riot police and barbed wire in Europe, sending back refugees, trying to stop them getting into Hungary. And a complete division between these new European nations, a Hungarian Prime Minister, Viktor Orban, pretty right-wing, very Christian fundamentalist, talking about Christian culture, and the rest of Europe saying, actually, this is much more complicated than that.
We're going to take a very short break, and when we come back, we're going to continue our conversation about this migrant crisis in Europe, what Europeans are trying to do, what the United States is being pressured to do, and we'll take your calls and questions. Our phone lines are open, 1-800-433-8850, or send us an email, drshow@wamu.org. Stay with us.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
DCS Daily.
It's news,
culture, and curiosities.
From the District, Tacoma Park,
Alexandria,
Friendship Heights,
Hyattsville,
Falls Church,
Northeast Washington, D.C., in your inbox every weekday afternoon.
DCS Daily. Sign up at dcs.com/newsletter.
dcs.com/newsletter.
Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. With us for the international hour of our Friday News Roundup, Elise Labbitt. She's global affairs correspondent for CNN. And David Loyne. He's a foreign correspondent for the BBC. He's currently on sabbatical. He's the author of In Afghanistan, 200 Years of British, Russian, and American Occupation. And David Rothkopf, he's CEO and editor of the FP Group, which publishes Foreign Policy magazine. He's the author of National Insecurity, American Leadership in an Age of Fear. He also has a foreign policy podcast called The Editor's Roundtable. Well, David Rothkopf, let's talk about what we saw happening this week on the migrant crisis in Europe. Terrible actions in Hungary, riot police behaving as these migrants in a very violent way. Tell us about that.
Well, I mean, they were behaving violently, as we were talking about a moment ago. There is a strong right-wing element in Hungary that's trying to keep them out. It has forced them to redirect the route of these refugees. But I think the thing that's more important is this problem is going to get much worse before it gets better. Because as the fighting continues in Syria and there's no end in sight, and as the fighting continues in places like Libya where there is no end in sight, and the fighting continues to pressure people into Europe, they're going to come into the parts of Europe that are having economic problems right now, Greece and Italy and Spain, the places that don't have the ability to keep them out and don't have the ability to absorb them. And what's that going to do? It's going to fuel more right-wing groups like the ones in Hungary, and those right-wing groups in turn are going to gain political power. They're against the EU, they're against the cohesion of the EU, and then on top of all of that, they have entered into these kind of interesting alliances with Vladimir Putin, who's cultivated them because he'd like to see the EU weaken. So all of a sudden, inaction in Syria by the West produces a refugee flow, which produces consequences in Europe, which could weaken the Atlantic Alliance in fundamental ways, and is being manipulated to do just that.
Well, and it's also causing, you know, divisions in Europe, because as David mentioned, you know, originally these people are not necessarily looking to go to Hungary or Croatia or Serbia. They're looking to go west to Germany, where they think that they'll have a lot more opportunity. Traditionally, Germany has been very welcoming to refugees. And Angela Merkel, the chancellor, has in fact said that, you know, look, we'll take in as many Syrian refugees as we can. The problem is there are just too many of them. And Germany is saying, listen, we're going to do what we can, but these smaller countries have to share the burden. And so on one hand, Germany, once again, as you saw with the financial crisis and other issues, feels that it's sharing the, you know, lion's share for the taking the lion's share for the rest of the smaller countries. These smaller countries feel bullied by Germany. And so what Germany is proposing now is for, you know, countries to divvy up the refugees. And so European leaders are going to meet next week to discuss the refugee crisis. But it certainly is causing divisions between the larger European nations like Germany and the smaller Eastern Europe.
Well, and divisions within the larger nations, so that my own country, Britain, and Germany disagree fundamentally over this. And Germany, I think, is beginning to be in a bit of a state of shock. The German system can't cope with the number of people. They can't cope with this great pull. The British policy has been to take refugees. They say they'll take refugees from Lebanon. They'll go to Lebanon and select them. And the Prime Minister makes the point that Britain has put more aid into the region, into the Syrian region, than the whole of the rest of Europe combined. It's a very big aid flow. So their policy, they feel, is coherent, and it doesn't pull refugees across Europe. And so I think the arguments are big, and you do have the EU completely in disarray over something which, as David says, is absolutely at our borders.
Well, let's go to Joe, who's calling us from South Bend, Indiana. Joe, hi, you're on the air.
Hi. Basically, my question is, you know, President Obama should play a leadership role, go to the EU, and build a coalition, and go to the UN. And basically make a multi-pronged pressure on the UN and make, you know, facilitate the solution through the UN. And the refugee problem is a symptom of the problem, not the problem.
Yeah. Joe, thanks so much for your call. You know, we have a similar email from Boyd, who writes us from Alexandria, Virginia. He writes, I've not heard anything from President Obama about the humanitarian refugee crisis in Europe. Isn't there something we can do? And don't we have a moral obligation to help, especially as we seem unable to resolve and perhaps help cause the war in Syria? David Rothkopf, do we have the United States have a moral obligation to do more than we're doing now?
Yeah, I think we do have a moral obligation. I think the moral obligation takes many forms. I think we should accept more refugees ourselves. And there are a lot of proposals saying we should up the proposed number that we'll take in to perhaps 100,000. But as the caller suggests, the real issue is Syria. The real issue is unrest in the Middle East. American inaction, the president's reluctance to take action in Syria, which has now produced over 200,000 dead and 6 to 7 million people dislocated, and this flow of refugees, is likely to be the biggest blot on his foreign policy record. And I think rather than, you know, wring our hands about that, I think it's time that the U.S. works with other countries, and it's going to have to include Russia and Iran, the Saudis, the Qataris, and the Turks. But we are going to have to work together to find some kind of a solution and take some risks, recognizing that not all the options are good, not all the outcomes are absolutely secure, and there's going to be some messiness around the edges of this thing. The president's been reluctant on that. It's cost him. It's cost the Syrian people. It's now costing Europe.
Is the administration rethinking how many Syrian refugees we will take in, Elise?
Well, this last year took in about 1,800. Now there's talk about taking in as many as 10,000. The UN U.S. ambassador to the UN, Samantha Powers, said this week that the U.S. is looking to take in many more than that, perhaps 17,000, maybe even more than that. I mean, there are calls from members of Congress to take 60,000. Some have even said 100,000. I mean, the U.S. will point out that it is the largest funder of refugees around the world. And what they try to do is they try to give money to people on the ground so that they, you know, the goal is to get these people home. You know, if they're coming so far and resettling here in the United States, then it's not as easy to get them back to their home once the conflict ends. But, I mean, as, you know, we've been saying, this conflict is showing no end in sight. And, you know, Europe is being overly burdened. I think that there is a desire by the U.S. to take a more leadership role. Secretary Kerry should be discussing this in Europe this weekend. And obviously, it will be a big issue at the United Nations General Assembly at the end of the month.
Let's go to St. Louis, Missouri, and talk to Lalani. Lalani, hi. Thanks for calling us.
Hello. I'm Mumtaz Lalani, St. Louis, Missouri. I have a little trouble about why not any Arabian country. Saudi Arabia has capacity of about 100,000 tents, all vacant. All the UAE, you know, the Middle Eastern states, only Lebanon and Jordan has taken some refugees. Those are poor countries. All the rich countries are doing nothing. Why nobody is talking about that? They should come up and pitch something. These are their brothers in Islam. They always want a brother in Islam. If they want their things, you know, like suicide bombers. But when they have to come and help, nobody's helping.
All right, we'll talk about it, Lani. David Loring.
Mumtaz, you make a point really well. And of course, you know, UAE and Qatar, hugely rich nations. I mean, they don't have much capacity for refugee camps. They're nations in the sand. But Lebanon, certainly, neighboring Syria, one in four of the Lebanese population at the moment are refugees from the Syrian and Iraqi conflicts. And that country has taken an extraordinary hit. And the previous caller, Joe, was talking about the United Nations. Of course, it's the UN who run the camps in those places with, you know, international aid, American aid. But you make the point really well that the Arab neighbours of Syria and Iraq and Libya are not taking in refugees. Of course, they're terrified of the contagion of the war, of Islamic State spreading to them. They're terrified of this coming into their patch. And all we've seen Saudi Arabia doing this year is bomb Yemen, their neighbour, their first really aggressive foreign war, which they conducted on their own, and they conducted it appallingly, killing thousands of civilians.
But it's actually not true that they're not taking refugees. The United Arab Emirates, since the beginning of the war in Syria, has taken in 100,000 people, not as refugees, but as residents. They've also contributed more as a percentage of GDP to dealing with the refugee issue. The Saudis are trying to make the case they're doing the same. But I do think with regard to the Yemen war, we have to keep in mind there is a huge humanitarian crisis brewing there. 6 to 7 million people in danger of starvation. So in addition to however they're dealing with what's going on in Syria, they are also going to have to deal with that crisis in very short order.
Well, and I think when we talk about bringing the Syrians in as kind of residents or temporary residents or workers or something, there opens up a lot of questions about how those people, you know, one of the reasons that they're reluctant to take in large numbers of people is because if you look at countries like Qatar, the UAE, Bahrain, these smaller nations, not necessarily Saudi, who said that they are going to take up to 2 million Syrian refugees. I've failed to see that so far. But some of these smaller countries, their population proportionally are already not indigenous. They're from Bangladesh. They're workers that are coming in from other places. So it's really not only a concern, obviously, security-wise, about possibly some ISIS people coming in, but they're also worried about it disturbing the fabric of these small societies.
Here's an email from Phil, who's listening to our show in Indianapolis. He writes, does Russia or China take in Syrian refugees? Have they stepped up? Anybody know?
The answer is I don't know. is a short answer. I mean, would you want to go to Russia as a Syrian refugee? A lot of this is flight of choice. Tens of thousands of the people now heading across into Europe and trying to find their way around this great human tide of people. And one of them said this week, if we meet a rock, we get round it. Many of them have been in Turkey and Greece for some time, and they're now being pulled by the idea that there is safe haven in Germany. They don't want to head east to Russia.
Well, that's part of the reason the Russian tanks are where the Russian tanks are, and the Russian airport is where the Russians want to block the flow of the problems of the Middle East into Russia. They see that as their own neighborhood, and they see a movement like this, quite apart from the U.S., which views it as sending troops to the other side of the world. The Russians see this as a way of trying to contain problems from spreading into Russia and its near abroad, its neighbors.
Here's an email from Phil, who writes us from Hadley, New York. Every interview or video I see with a young, sensible, English-speaking Syrians fleeing their country makes me despair about ever regaining stability in the Middle East. If smart, motivated, peace-loving families keep leaving, accepting them into the West seems like long-term madness masquerading as short-term mercy.
Well, that's the thing. And, you know, we keep going back between the migrant crisis and the Syrian crisis, and we see how interrelated they are. And what these people, you know, it used to be that you wanted to go to America or somewhere to, you know, set up a new life because things, you know, didn't have great opportunities in your country. Now it's a matter of survival, of life or death. And so I think when you look at a country like Germany, what Angela Merkel has proposed is finding jobs for these people. Certainly there's a labor shortage in Germany, and a lot of these people can come in and find jobs. And I think that's going to have to be part of the solution, is bringing these people into Europe and finding, you know, how they can fit into society and contribute.
I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to The Diane Rehm Show. We're taking your calls 1-800-433-8850. David Loin.
Well, on the point of smart people leaving countries and making it far harder for those countries to recover, I just compare it with Afghanistan, which has been at war for more than 30 years, where I was correspondent until last month. I've been living for the last 2 years. And right at the beginning of the Russian war, 1978-1979, one of the figures I heard at the time, 90% of Afghanistan's university teachers fled the country. Mm. And it's no wonder that it's been really hard for that country to recover. It'll be really difficult for these Arab countries to recover. And I should say, Afghanistan now has the smartest, young, clever ambassador in Kabul, in Washington. He arrived yesterday. Gave his credentials to President Obama, had dinner with him last night, and he is going to do good things for his country, and America should continue to support that country.
And his name is?
His name is Hamdullah Mahib, and he and his American wife are now living in Northwest Washington, and he's smart, and you know, when you're a correspondent living somewhere, you fall in love with the country. And I should say that if Afghanistan falls off the international radar, that would be a real shame. And it would be a real shame for the 2,300 U.S. Families who are mourning their dead, and the hundreds of European families who fought a war in order to stabilize a country. And it's getting better, but it does still need help.
David Rothkopf.
Well, I fear that fall off the radar is precisely what's going to happen in Afghanistan. And I think if we take a step back and we look at the work that the international community has. Right now, there are 60 million displaced people in the world, which is the most since the end of World War II. So it's not just Syria or Libya or what's happening elsewhere in the Middle East, but it's also on the Colombia-Venezuela border. It's also people, Rohingya, moving in Myanmar and so forth. We have a major problem in Africa, millions of people moving. We have a major problem in the world that the United Nations and the international community is not dealing with right now, and it's causing an enormous amount of human suffering.
Let's go to the phones and talk to Shyam, who's calling us from East Lansing, Michigan. Hi, you're on the Diane Rehm Show.
Hi, thank you for taking my call. My name is Shyam, and I'm American Syrian from Aleppo, Syria, and right now I have family over here. And my comment is that, like your last guest said, nobody knows the madness and the misery people are going through right now. And this is the result, the refugee crisis is the result of the failure of United States and the United Nations in stopping this war.
And yes, please go ahead.
My question right now, we cannot keep trying different results. We need to stop this war because people are suffering. My family, they are without water, without electricity for the last 2 weeks in a row. They get water for 1 hour or they have to buy water. They don't have electricity. They don't have food. And do you know what will happen to the Christian people if we don't have a plan, if we remove Assad? I want one of your guests to reply to my question.
Shyam, we'll do that. Let me just ask you, have any members of your family joined this exodus from Syria recently?
No. You know, the Christians, they are in the control area, and they are protected by the government. But 2 days ago, they had 9 attacks. Over 100 people died. 11 kids in the public school, it was the first day of school, they died. And nobody is paying attention.
Shyam, that's terrible. We're so sorry for the deaths there, and we hope things go well for your family. We want to talk about this important question that you raise about whether U.S. policy has contributed to this crisis. First, we're going to take a short break, and after that, we'll come back. We'll deal with your question, and we'll talk also about the situation in North Korea and concerns about the nuclear program there. Stay with us. Welcome back. I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane Rehm. It's the international hour of our Friday News Roundup. And with me in the studio, David Loin of the BBC, Elise Labatt of CNN, David Rothkopf of Foreign Policy Magazine. Now, we just had a caller, a Syrian-American, Shyam, calling us from Michigan, saying that the United States bears a lot of responsibility for the situation in Syria. We've got a debate going on Twitter and Facebook about that, a lot of pushback to that idea. A tweet that says, there's no way to know if Western intervention in the Syrian civil war would have changed the trajectory of the refugee crisis. That comes from a tweeter called You Thought You Knew. And an email from Marcy in Cincinnati that says, how do you support the argument that U.S. action in Syria a few years ago would have brought us to a better place when we did act in Iraq and Afghanistan, and pretty much everyone thinks all we did was create instability? To what degree does our panel think the United States bears some responsibility for this catastrophic situation in Syria? David Rothkopf?
I think the United States bears a great deal of responsibility, but let's be clear. History plays a role in this. The Assad regime, which has been brutal, plays a role in this. ISIS and other terrorist groups play a huge role in this. It's not simple. And clearly, the Obama administration is absolutely right that we have not seen an easy solution, a clear-cut path to victory, clear allies to work with. But the alternative, inaction, has produced a catastrophic result. And sometimes, when you are not presented with great alternatives, you nonetheless have to seize the best possible alternative. We have not done that. We have allowed this situation to fester. We have not led the international community as we could have. We have not created humanitarian areas as we could have. We have not created a no-fly zone as we could have. We have not trained the best possible rebels as we could have. We have not put pressure on the Qataris and the Turks to stop supporting bad guys in the way that we could have. The list of things we could have done goes on. And by the way, it's not the administration. During the first term of this administration, Hillary Clinton, Leon Panetta, other people within the administration were pushing for us to do just this. The president didn't want to do it, and this issue lies at the president's doorstep.
Elise, what do you think?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, most of the president's aides, I think the president has found himself very isolated in the last term on this issue. Most of his national security team, I say most, maybe there are a few that did not, believe that the president should have gotten more robustly involved. And this was foreseeable. When there was a lot of talk about stepping up aid to the rebels, lethal aid, helping train up the opposition and the rebels, and the president was reluctant. He said that he was afraid that, you know, more guns and more weapons in the area would create more extremism. The opposite argument was that if you do nothing, extremism will grow and fester. And that's exactly what happened. And now the administration, who is trying to train rebels not to go after Bashar al-Assad, who they said 5 years ago should be out of office, to go after ISIS, the extremism that was created by the lack of inaction. And now you see that that effort has gone astray. Out of the first class of 60 rebels that they trained, maybe, you know, the head of this effort said four or five are actually on the battlefield. So it's the lack of inaction that created situations that now they're desperately trying to curb.
And you hear Hillary Clinton on the campaign trail making the point over and over again, I urged more action at the point that the president decided not to take it.
She urged more action, as David said. You know, Robert Gates did, General Petraeus when he was in the government. Most of the people did. This president was very reluctant. You remember the whole debacle with the red line on Syria chemical weapons. The president, Secretary Kerry, announced very publicly that the U.S. was gearing up for military action. I mean, it was just moments away when the president backtracked and decided
and said he would seek congressional approval,
which didn't come.
Well, he was very keen at the time to get international support for that. And you'll remember that there was this vote in the British House of Commons, which Obama expected to win. Obama expected that that Britain would be behind America again, as they had been in Iraq in 2003. And the Labour Party pulled the rug from the vote at the last minute. And completely changed the dynamics over here.
Well, it didn't completely change it. That was 3 days before the decision to be made. Well, but it was 3 days before the decision was made to go in. Kerry went on and made the casus belli remarks at about noon on a Friday, and it was 4 or 5 hours later that the president walks around the South Lawn of the White House with his chief of staff and decides not to do it after having announced to do it.
Well, and then there was this, you know, whole agreement to get rid of Syrian chemical weapons, but we see that the Syrians have adapted. Bashar al-Assad is now, you know, using more lethal forms of chlorine gas against his people. Look, well, let's not say the administration didn't try. They tried a lot of things that did not work. And when they tried to train up an opposition and it didn't work, then they slowed that down. When they tried to get a political transition and it didn't work, they slowed that down. So it's not about them didn't trying. It's that they didn't try something else.
We have a lot of defenders of President Obama on Facebook and Twitter. Here's an email from Barry who writes, short of U.S. boots on the ground in Syria, what are Mr. Obama's options? I do not want my son, who is in the military, to die in Syria. There are no good options. I think that's something on which we would all agree with Barry.
I agree with David completely that there are a series of military actions short of outright war that maybe could and should have been tried. But it's a salutary reminder that when we started talking about military intervention in Syria, it was against the government, and now it's against, as it were, the opposition.
But that
that opposition has emerged since we did nothing against the government.
That has to do, of course, partially with our policy in Iraq. And, you know, Iraq was a catastrophe. It was an enormous waste of U.S. resources. It cost enormous amount to countless American families who lost people there, as well as Iraqi families. Let's stipulate that. But in 2008, when the president took office, Iraq was stable, and there was some prospect of continued stability. The president said he wanted out. He didn't want to establish a status of forces agreement that would allow troops to stay. He didn't try to do it. He pulled out too quickly. It created a void. And if they say, well, they didn't want the status of forces agreement, if that's the counterargument, well, now we have 4,000 troops or 3,000 some odd troops in Iraq without a status of forces agreement.
I don't think it would have been possible in 2008 for that agreement to take place. The Iraqis didn't want American troops to stay a moment longer. And I don't think there was an option for that.
But I think you need to look at the bigger picture. And David makes a very good case on Iraq, but you can also look at Libya. We've talked about Afghanistan. It's one thing to go in and make some efforts to stabilize the place, but you have to clear, and then, you know, kind of we talked about this strategy of clear, hold, and build. Military action needs to be followed by sustained political, diplomatic, and humanitarian engagement. And I think that's where this administration has lacked, that if you're going to withdraw from Iraq, if after the invasion of Libya, when the overthrow of Muammar Gaddafi, you need to sustain this type of engagement to help these people rebuild a society that's self-sustaining.
Let's talk about the situation in North Korea. More provocation this week with statements about nuclear weapons, long-range missiles. David Loin, what have we heard this week?
It's all about food aid at the end of the day. Everything in North Korea all comes down to food aid. Every time anything happens in the international world, North Korea launches another missile, says they're going to carry out a nuclear test. Me too is the word from the dictator. You have 70% of the population dependent on international aid, one-third of them completely food insecure. Just occasionally, 4 or 5 years ago, America tried to cut food aid and see if that would work, but it never does. And the connection between this kind of clown regime, of course, it's not a clown regime if you're living there,
and any sort of sense of reaction with
nuclear weapons, and that's given nuclear technology to Pakistan, and a number of very interesting stuff in the WikiLeaks papers showing Afghan guerrillas going to see the North Koreans and trying to get nuclear technology from them. Very interesting and difficult and complex regime, but it is not about to launch a nuclear attack.
I think we're in a totally different game with this Kim Jong-un, who is even more unpredictable, erratic than his father. And when the North Koreans say, we're going to restart our nuclear reactor, we're going to launch a satellite, which is really seen as an intercontinental ballistic missile, they do it. And the U.S. is gearing up now for North Korea to make possibly another nuclear test to launch this missile. And this Secretary of State Kerry is warning of grave consequences.
Consequences. What does that mean? What would we do?
I mean, there are a lot of things that the U.S. could do. I mean, they could beef up their, military posture in Asia. Probably what you'll see is some kind of international condemnation at the United Nations. That's what they're talking about. I mean, David is right. In the end, the severe consequences will probably be North Korea getting some aid to kind of keep them quiet and go back in their box. But I mean, look, this is a very unstable. If you thought that, Kim Jong-il was unpredictable, erratic and unstable, this young leader is seen as even more so. And I think there are a lot of concerns about what's to come with him.
Bill Clinton used to have a line about this, which he said North Korea's only cash crop was its nuclear program, right? and I think that that's true. Having said that, there is a bigger issue here that resonates with other things that are going on in the world. The United States has achieved quite a step forward with an Iranian nuclear deal and is hailing this as a step against proliferation. But having said that, at the same time, North Korea is moving forward with its nuclear program. Pakistan now has 200 nuclear warheads, is miniaturizing them, and is moving forward with its ability to deliver them. Russia is moving forward with the modernization of its nuclear program. Japan is inching ever closer to being out of the closet as a near-nuclear state. The state of nuclear proliferation in the world has deteriorated markedly, even as we have focused on the state of nuclear development in Iran.
Let's go to Birmingham, Alabama, and talk to John. John, thanks for giving us a call.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and I'm a first-time caller. I guess the issue that I'm most concerned about, as an American and travel abroad some, is the element that comes into those countries, the ISIS element, the bad element that's sort of, there's a lot of women and children. Yes, we need to take care of them, and we need to make sure that they're fed and have a place to stay. But how do you separate the bad from the good when you have so many people coming into those countries, pushing their way in, wanting jobs and needing help? So how do we separate that?
That's just a great question, Elise.
This is, John, one of the major concerns of the European countries. I mean, it used to be that people would flow into these countries in a very orderly fashion. They would be processed, they would be vetted, and then they would be resettled somewhere. Now when you're seeing tens, possibly hundreds of thousands of these migrants, it's impossible to vet them. And that's the big concern, that a lot of these people that are sympathizing with ISIS that went to train in perhaps Iraq and Syria are going to make their way back through Europe.
Have we seen evidence that ISIS or other terror groups are using this opportunity to infiltrate the migrants, the refugees?
Well, they say that's what they're doing. That's what they say on their social media sites.
They're encouraging them.
They absolutely, and they see this as all part of their policy. The number of refugees that are coming across. There's no evidence that someone in a boat has then ended up, then trying to blow somebody up in a European city.
John, thanks so much for your question. I'm Susan Page, and you're listening to the Diane Rehm Show. We had Mexican tourists in Egypt who were killed by Egyptian forces, by a helicopter gunship. How in the world did this happen, David Rothkopf?
Well, it was clearly a mistake by the Egyptian authorities, who are trigger-happy when it comes to potential terrorists. And this Egyptian regime has, at every turn, sent a message that it is going to be repressive on these issues. It has had advice from its near allies saying, tone it down. They don't do it. Now, on top of what's just happened here, they're saying that the press can't cover what happened with regard to the murder of these Mexicans. And it's repellent. And at a certain point, the tolerance for the Sisi regime on its hard-line behavior is going to break down in the West. Right now, we're giving them a little bit of room because, frankly, we need stability in Egypt. There are too many other problems in this part of the world. But they can push it too far. And with things like this, they're getting perilously close.
I mean, could you imagine what we'd be talking about if this was a tour bus of Americans, which it could have easily has been?
Well, the Egypt said that they were in a controlled zone, but I think the Mexicans dispute the idea that the tourists had done anything.
Well, they do, and it's very unclear. I mean, as David says, no one's been allowed to report it properly. I mean, the reports that are coming out was that they were actually stopped at a rest stop, and they'd stopped to eat sandwiches when this happened. Although the Egyptians say they were traveling in a prohibited area, I would just say it is shameful that Egypt treats journalists in the way that it does. You know, still they have these three Al Jazeera journalists, Peter Grester, a friend of mine, and his two colleagues, still facing these convictions. You know, journalism is not a crime, as the hashtag puts it, and Egypt has made ordinary, sensible journalism into a criminal offence, and it's a shameful thing to do.
And what is the Mexican government doing?
Well, the Mexican foreign minister arrived, is going to meet with Al-Sisi, if she didn't already, and they want an investigation. I mean, look, there's not that much that they can do except, you know, demand that there's some kind of investigation and that I get a clear answer about this so it doesn't happen again. Sisi called the Mexican president, offered his condolences, said it was a terrible mistake and there would be an investigation. But, you know, as we said, it's clearly the optics of this are terrible.
So, David Loin, some encouraging news for Bernie Sanders coming out of London, and that is his new Labor leader who some people refer to as the Bernie Sanders of Britain. Who is he?
So he's my constituency MP, as it happens, Jeremy Corbyn. He is a long, 67-year-old, long-term backbench Labour MP, never expected political power. And Carly Fiorina is wrong to say that people don't talk about men's clothing and men's appearances. There's been a lot of discussion about Jeremy Corbyn's appearance, his rumpled jackets and his shirt pocket with the pens in and the sort of, you know, the shambling sort of polytechnic lecturer look that he has. Although his white cotton T-shirt became a brief sex item on Twitter in London. He was, but he is. I mean, the serious point is. So the Labour Party lost the election in the spring. They had a long night of the soul. He only just got onto the ballot for nomination as leader because they wanted to have a discussion, including some left-wing candidates. And he was 200-1 right at the beginning. You could put a dollar on and get $200 back on Jeremy Corbyn. And he came right through on the first round, 59% of the poll. And he has got some key Tony Blair supporters, Charlie Faulkner included, who was his justice minister, among his ministers. But his finance minister, John McDonnell, is a genuine left-winger and who wants to do something called people's quantitative easing, which is basically the Bank of England printing whatever money they wanted to do to pay people whatever they wanted for whatever. His economic policy is a disaster. And his friends internationally are rogues and criminals. And many of the things that he said in the background in the past, you know, if you're on the extreme left, you sit in places and you say, these are my friends, and they are his friends, and now all of that's come out from YouTube, and of course that's looking bad. But he is leader of Her Majesty's opposition as of today.
David Loin, he's with the BBC. Elise Labbitt with CNN. David Rothkopf from Foreign Policy Group. Thank you all for joining us this hour on the Diane Rehm Show.
Thank you.
Thanks.
I'm Susan Page of USA Today, sitting in for Diane. She'll be back on Monday. Thanks for listening.